We're breaking out this time.
AM 950, it's Matt McNeil. Thanks for being with us today. My next interview is the author Lynn Enger. He has books out, Undiscovered Country, The High Divide, and his latest book is American Gospel, a novel. He's kind enough today to talk about this book with us. Thank you very much. Hey, Lynn, how are you?
I'm doing well, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for giving us some time today. Why don't we find a little bit about your background, because you've pretty much spent a good chunk of your life here in Minnesota, right?
I've spent nearly my whole life in Minnesota. I was born in central Minnesota, and for the last almost three decades, I've been teaching English at Minnesota State Moorhead. So, yeah, I've been here a long time.
And you're from a town you were raised on, a town out in central Minnesota, correct?
That's right, Osakis, which is on a beautiful lake called Osakis Lake. It's about 2 hours northwest of Minneapolis on I-94.
And I find it, I mean, obviously this is a little bit of a background because this book takes place in Minnesota. Talk about, why don't you give us a general overview of what the story is about here in American Gospel?
Yeah. It is set in Minnesota. The novel American Gospel, takes place in 2 weeks of August 1974, which if you're old enough or know your history, you know that was a tumultuous month in American history. It's the month Richard Nixon resigned the presidency. So while that's going on in Washington, D.C., on a lake in northern Minnesota, an old man, he's a farmer turned preacher, survives a near-death experience, during which he has a vision that the rapture is going to occur in just 14 days on August 19th. And so the novel dramatizes those 14 days. Pilgrims and journalists descend on what becomes ground zero for the end of the world. So that's basically the story in a nutshell.
And it obviously the farmer, the prophet is a main key part of the story, but as also his son and a former neighbor, correct?
Yeah, that's right. His son is a skeptic. He's a writer trying to make a career in New York City, and the neighbor who grew up next to him, a girl, has grown up, and she is now an Oscar-winning actress in Hollywood, and it's largely through her that the media attaches to this story and raises its profile. The aerial view, what I think is especially interesting right now, considering what's happening in this country, but the aerial view of this book is you've got somebody with a pathological need to be the one who has all the answers, the one who knows what people need to know, and invents a reality out of whole cloth. And when he presents himself to the world with that invented reality, there's a rush in his direction because there are so many people who want to be led, who want to be told how to think, and therefore freed from having to figure things out for themselves. And so they embrace that invented reality. That's the story, you know, one way to look at this story, especially in light of what's happening in this country right now.
Well, and one of the things, I'm a little younger than you. I was 68. I was born in 68. And but I remember, and it's hard to try to tell people about what was sensationalized and how things got sensationalized pre-internet. And you know, the way that you approach this is exactly how I remember things like this happening. There was didn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. It just all of a sudden just manifested itself. And all of a sudden you had this big media push in a part of the country that was generally flyover country for most of the time, but all of a sudden became the center of America for 2 weeks at a time. And it's a nice refresher of how things used to be like that. You talk a little bit about the rapture here. I want to address how you approach that, because the one of the things I find to be interesting about, you know, the rapture when we it is discussed. On one side, you have a lot of people that think, you know, okay, this is 1300, you know, century fan fiction. that is been put forward in the church, and they don't take it very seriously. But there are a lot of people who do take the rapture very seriously. It's an interesting topic to try to broach.
Well, it really is. Maybe even a little sensitive. There was a Pew research study done a few years back, and on this very subject, and they found that over 40%, I think it was 41%, you can look it up, percent of American adults believe that the rapture would happen before the middle of this century. So, yeah, there's a large percentage of the people who do take it seriously. And the weird thing is, that's not so. I mean, that's fine. It's part of you know, a doctrine sort of, or has become doctrine in a large part of the church. But I think the frightening thing is that there are people who make these very hard predictions routinely. Mm-hmm. Ever since I've been a kid, I've watched this happen around me. People predicting it's going to happen by the end of the decade or end of this year or, you know, on Tuesday. It's not unusual that somebody comes along and believes, or wants people to think he believes, that he's figured out the date of the end. And the date always passes, and then the person sort of shrugs and goes on. And it always kind of irritated me, annoyed me. And so I thought, well, wow, I mean, it would be an interesting thing to put a spotlight on that person, because I've known those people, and try to get into their head, and then also really investigate sort of psychologically what happens to that person and to the people around them who buy in. And then what happens if it doesn't come to pass. So, yeah, it was a ripe story for a fiction writer, for this fiction writer. And I had a lot of fun writing it.
Well, and it's really interesting because as you talk about that, you're right. And then all of a sudden there becomes a moment in the 70s. It was Jim Jones that all of a sudden kind of stopped. It started back up again in the late 80s. And then all of a sudden came Waco and it stopped. Yeah. And now we are starting to see this again. Was there a specific incident or moment that influenced this? Is there one in mind, or is this more of just an amalgamation of multiple different incidents of those early 70s?
Well, it is, like you say, it's an amalgamation of many. However, just before I started writing the draft that this book became, I was going to a graduation here at MSU in the spring of 2011. And as I walked into the Nemzik Hall where the graduation was to be held, there was a big bus, a big commercial bus, with that had signs along the side that said, you know, prepare for the end. The end is coming on, I think it was May 21st, 2011. And there were people in that bus that had loudspeakers. And as people were going into the graduation, they were blasting us with these warnings that the rapture was about to happen. And at that point, I mean, I suppose it was a few days before May 21st. And I thought, holy cats, you know, does this ever end? This was sponsored by a man in California. His name was Harold Camping, and he had a big Christian radio show out there in California. He was very old, and he was, you know, broadcasting this idea that the end was coming. He'd figured it out, May 21st. Throughout the country, people sold their homes, gave him the money, and joined him in this mission to educate everybody, warn everybody that the end was about to happen. So here they showed up in Moorhead, Minnesota. They were in every state in the union doing this. It was a fairly big deal. It did get quite a lot of news coverage. And of course, the next day after May 21st, on the 22nd, the journalist showed up at Harold Camping's door, pounding on the door, saying, "Hey, man, what's going on?" Finally, late in the afternoon, he stuck his head out sort of sheepishly and said a few words. You know, he didn't apologize. He just said, "Well, actually, I made a mistake. I guess it's going to be October." You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember that.
You remember that? Yeah, I mean, it was kind of crazy. But for me, it wasn't anything new because I'd seen this. You know, Pat Robertson did it about a month ago. You know, he didn't have a specific date, but he said Trump's going to win the election. And after that, we're going to have the tribulation and there's going to be an asteroid that hits the Earth. So, you know, this is happening all the time. Sometimes one of these predictions kind of gets traction and people pay more attention. And so I dramatized one of those instances, fictionalized one. Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of a microcosm, my book, a microcosm of what we see happening a lot in this country. Sometimes it's a religious person who has all the answers. Sometimes it's a political personality. But people are a little gullible.
Well, and I find it, as you talk about this, I mean, there must have been, to a point, a little wild. I mean, we do live in a time where, you know, people love zombie films and asteroids. And, you know, they talk with a smile on their face about how we're all about to get wiped out. And you're like, okay, do you guys hear yourselves? And I mean, it's just, you know, I think that there is a tendency, like I said, I think there is a tendency of the times, and you touch on it in 74, we can go through these times, where we realize that people are frustrated and people are sad and things are not working out the way they want to. So it's easier to believe that it's not just that you backed the wrong presidential candidate or your girlfriend left you or one of these things, that there's this larger grand scheme in place where, you know, we're all just going to, you know, let's just greet it as it comes. And I think that it's got to be wild to be able to write something today, especially as warped as our society has become via the internet, and realize well before the internet was here, this warping was happening, but it was just happening in a different way.
Yeah, you know, that's so true. Internet certainly has changed our culture in radical ways. Some for the better, some obviously for the worse. But we haven't changed. You know, people mm-hmm. haven't changed. And you're right. This kind of almost seems to me almost a lust for apocalypse, a lust for the end, I think comes, as you suggest, from a need for a sense of control. I mean, we always see it when some kind of, well, right now we have a pandemic, and there's been a lot of this kind of apocalyptic talk, especially on the internet, around the pandemic. I mean, this now is the end. Remember Y2K before the turn of the century, planes were going to fall out of the skies. It was all going to grind to a halt, and that was going to usher in the end. And, you know, a lot of people put away water and food and cash in preparation for the great tribulation that was going to be ushered in by, January 1st, 2000. I remember that very well. I knew people who did it. So yeah, it's a kind of become a routine panic, that I don't think it'll never change. I think this is what we'll continue to see.
Well, I think it's funny because it's like you said, oh yeah, we have a pandemic going on, and I've actually talked to people, well, not that international crisis. There's going to be another one. Oh, okay. So you've been calling for this, but now it's like it's like a buffet line. I don't want to miss one element of your story here, which is, as a person who has lived in small town America as well, you do focus on the concepts of family and neighborhoods and community here. The actress, I believe, as she comes back, she's a former neighbor here, and that there's the interest there. Talk about the dynamics there, because I think that it's at the root of this book is kind of that it's a story of a small town and the relationships that are built, and even though they kind of go out of control, and you know, we get to raptures and Hollywood stars, and you know, and sons trying to deal with their parents, the reality is it's still the same kind of relations that you have just in pretty much every community, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. I grew up in a small town, so I understand small towns. And this is definitely a book about community and about the way community works. And in the case of this actress, it's kind of a complicated relationship between her and the community, because she went off sort of under a cloud of shame, disappeared actually, and never came back. And of course, once she made it big in Hollywood, the town took note. But she didn't reciprocate. She never allowed herself to acknowledge the town she came from. So there's a kind of a hard feelings, it seemed to me, on the part of the town toward her. But nevertheless, she does come back. It's a story about the return to the place of place of birth, the place of community. She returns, the son of the preacher. He's on the East Coast and he returns. So the novel is about this return to community, this magnetic, pull that the place of origin has on various, you know, the various, different kinds of personalities in the novel. But yeah, that's the general movement of the novel, from the dispersed moving back toward the place of origin.
Well, and I think that it's such a key dynamic that I think a lot of people in metro areas do not get, is that these towns have watched for 30 years, 40 years, every kid at 18 years old hit the door and never come back.
That's right.
And that palatable resentment is very real. I mean, we talk about things feeding into rapture theories and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's this mentality. You go to many small towns in America today, and the population is 55 and older or 18 and younger, and there's very few people in between.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you grew up in a small town in Minnesota or probably any other state, there was this understanding, unless your parents owned a business or a farm or something, this understanding that at 18, you know, you've got to fly and you have to find your way. And that's just a given. In many cases, there's I think on the part of young people, there's a just an anxiousness to leave, mm-hmm. because of the strictures that a small town often places upon them. But then there's also this pull in midlife, I think, to return. That often happens too. I can't tell you the number of people I know who have returned to the small town, either in middle life or old age. So it has a pull. First there's this push, and then there's a pull. And it just repeats itself, I think, again and again through the generations that way.
One last thing, Lynn Enger joining us here, American Gospel is the book. I love how you laid this book out. I mean, as you talk about it, it's 2 weeks away. You basically go day by day, chapter by chapter. It reads very fast. That's a well-done idea.
Thank you. Yeah, that was that to me was important. I had to find a way to create a sense of momentum or tension. And so once it occurred to me that I could make this prediction in the near future, you know, 14 days out, then I realized basically I would have a countdown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the structure of the book is a countdown. I did an early draft of this book about 25 years ago, and it didn't make use of that structure, and it wandered and it was very slow. It was about twice as long and very boring. And when it occurred to me to use that kind of structural device, then it was a pretty easy book to write.
And there are sometimes that people will get kind of, you know, poo-poo on the idea or something like that because, oh, it's a gimmick. The reality is if it's a tactic that when used correctly, like in your book, it does build that tension and it does get you to that point and it just draws you in and makes it to where it's like I said, it's a very good read and a quick read because you can see the end line from the beginning, which is you don't know where it's going to go. You don't understand the plot, but you know you know where you're heading. And I think there's a tendency to besmirch ideas which actually do work. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And of course, fiction writers are always in a position of having to condense, to distill, magnify, exaggerate. That means because fiction isn't real life. Fiction is an artistic rendition of real life, and therefore it has to have more power and more urgency because real life is actually made up of a lot of mundane moments that we are, you know, walking through almost blindly. So when you're making a piece of art or a piece of fiction literature, you have to find a way to intensify life to keep people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what this device did for me.
I will, one final note away from the book, I will say I hope things are going well. I know as I praise teachers constantly. You, of course, teaching English at Minnesota State University, Moorhead, I know it must not be easy as we're going through these times. I hope things are going well for you there.
Thank you. They're going very well. I'm teaching my courses online, and most of them are writing courses, and writing courses do lend themselves to that platform. And so, yeah, it's going very, very well.
My son's screaming at his physics workgroup right now online. Physics doesn't work as well.
Well, may not. I've been doing online teaching for a while. I mean, some of my courses every semester for years have been online, you know, one or two. So now doing all of them online, it was, for me, a pretty easy transition.
American Gospel, a novel. Lynn Enger, once again, you find this available, University of Minnesota Press, available everywhere. Lynn, thank you very much. I appreciate the time. And by all means, come back. Next book, please, come on back.
Sounds great, Matt. I really enjoyed the conversation.
We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.